This is the DRF Players Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the May 31st edition of the DRF Players Podcast. I'm your host, Peter Thomas Fornatal, back with you after a very fun and relaxing Memorial Day weekend. Not joined by the usual crew today. One of the usual crew is in the process of moving his family from his homestead in Manhattan, where he used to be able to walk to work, out to the wilds of Queens. Not really the wilds of Queens. Forest Hills, in fact. Apparently Mike's new neighborhood. So Mike will not be joining us today. I am joined by Jonathan Kinchin, a.k.a. at UT Big Hair. Jonathan, how did Memorial Day weekend treat you?
Well, it was good. Made a quick little swing at the pick six out at Santa Anita, which I think most horse players at least try to come up with something with that big of a carryover. It's our version of what they call free money. So it was good. I enjoyed it. I didn't do much. Got out to the park a little bit. My buddy Robert thought it'd be a good idea to go hang out at this park, and there's a bunch of standing water and mosquitoes, and so hopefully.
Summer in Texas. Yeah, you know, exactly. I imagine summer in Texas can be a little bit of a bummer.
Yo, man, I tell you what, it'll keep you inside. They're pretty nasty down here, the mosquitoes, so I try to steer clear.
How'd you do in the pick six? I had a couple questions for you about that, actually.
You know, I didn't do very well. I ran second a lot. So
one of those days.
Yeah, it's one of those deals where it's just, you know, it depends on the type of investment you're making. I didn't make a huge one, so, you know, you have to take some stand somewhere, and when those horses run second, you obviously don't win, so it was tough. I ran second, three times, I think.
Tell me about your approach when you're dealing with a carryover situation like that. Is it the kind of thing where, because of the free money aspect, and we should probably describe to folks what we mean by free money in a minute, but because of the free money aspect, does that make you play one that you wouldn't play otherwise? Does it just sort of lower the threshold of how happy you have to be with your opinion to play? Give me some insight on that.
Well, I mean, I think the biggest thing is the sequence itself. It depends on what your opinions are. You know, I mean, if it's one of those situations where you absolutely love a 7-to-1 shot and the type of horse that you would bet win on, and you could even see singling or using maybe, very aggressively in a position. And there's a carryover. It's the kind of day that you need to reach into your pocket and you need to make, whatever is a comfortable investment for you in that position. But if it's one of those deals where you're just kind of going through it and you're like, oh, I kind of like this horse, I kind of like that horse, I kind of like this horse, those are the ones I usually attack on in a very skinny way. And if I hit it, great. If I don't, no big deal. But I typically try not to let the pool influence the looseness of my play. I'd rather the sequence determine how I play it.
That's very smart. One of my favorite horse players to talk to is Maury Wolf, and Maury made the analogy to me once. If Powerball, it's a stretch. You got to sort of follow us through here for this analogy to work, but I think it's a good one. But if Powerball were a positive expectation game, and we'll talk about what we mean by positive expectation in a minute, but if you knew that more money was getting paid out of the Powerball pool than went into it, that doesn't necessarily in and of itself mean it's a good bet, just because the degree of difficulty is so high. Your odds of getting that sequence of numbers are so astronomical that you're kind of throwing your money away anyway. And I think the pick six and other jackpot wagers can be viewed in sort of a similar light. If it's just too hard, if you have no opinion and no way in, the carryover doesn't really even matter. You need fundamentally to have some ability to cash the bet for the positive expectation situation to really come into play. Let's talk to folks about what we mean by that. You're going to get first crack at explaining carryovers and positive expectations, and then I'll chime in if you're struggling with it.
Oh, you're the one that's written the books about handicapping. Yeah, so to me, the way I look at it is that, I guess the basic, from if you've never even heard of horse racing before, we all bet into a pool, and if no one wins that money or hits that bet or has the all correct, six correct, that money You know, I think the track keeps some of it. They keep some of their take, and then they push it to the next day. So that's pretty much free money. It was, those people aren't back. They might come back, but if they come back, they have to put in more money. They leave and their money stays, and now it's free money. So now it kind of is the starting point, the kicking off point for the next day's pool. And then in this situation, I think it was a double carryover, so that happened twice. So it started with, you know, $40,000, and then it rolled into $300,000, and then it, you know, whatever, and so $400,000, and then the pool got up to $2 million yesterday with people chasing that.
I haven't done the math on yesterday's carryover, but I know, for example, like the Gulfstream Rainbow 6 deal that we all played a few months ago, you can get to a point where there's so much money carried over that even with the new money that comes in and the track taking their cut of that new money, it's still enough to counterbalance the effect of the takeout. And you actually have a pool where more money gets paid out than goes in. So in that case, your dollar at the racetrack, assuming a 15% blended takeout, your dollar is worth 85 cents because a dollar goes into the pool and then for that dollar, 85 cents comes out. But in these rare and interesting positive expectation situations, your dollar can go in, and because of that money added in, it can come back worth $1.03 or $1.05, or gosh, it was even more for that Gulfstream one a few weeks ago. I forget the specifics, but it was something like a dollar was worth $1.10. So at the very least, what a carryover is going to do is reduce the effective takeout for you in the pick six, and at most, turn it into a situation where you can quantify your investment as being worth a certain percentage, which is something that we don't get to do that often in horse racing, and a lot of people are attracted to that situation when it occurs. For me, I think Jonathan made the key point. If you've got a strong opinion about the sequence anyway, that this is the time to invest. And even though it didn't work out for you yesterday, it did work out for a couple of people. We had a carryover in California and a carryover in New York. Do you have those payouts in front of you by chance, Jonathan?
I just kind of know them a little bit. I think the New York was like $400,000, which I think was just one winner. I'm not 100% positive, but I think it was just one winner. And then California was like $1.5 million, and I believe that was one winner as well. So
incredible result. Life-changing stuff if you were lucky enough to be able to come up with good enough to come up with that particular sequence of six winners. There was some connection to the contest world. I think I saw Roger Satina, who listens to the show periodically, had kind of a frustrating tale about what happened to him. Which one was he playing, and give the folks a, I think you saw that tweet, give the folks a rundown of what happened to Roger.
Yeah, he tweeted his ticket, so I don't mind talking about it. But it was he invested $200. He was 2x2 by single. He singled like a 15-1 shot, which is amazing.
That's great fruit.
By five, by single, by five. And his only miss was the even money single, who was also one of my singles in the fifth leg, who ran second. And it was beaten by a horse that 2 weeks ago he beat by five lengths. So frustrating result there for Roger in that situation. He was probably looking at, obviously, it wouldn't have taken down the whole pool if that single would have hit in that leg. But I would imagine he was still looking at without a doubt, a six-digit score.
What did his five consolation come back anything to speak of, do you know?
Yeah, I think it came back like 2,000. So he got 10-1 on his money, which is, you know, that's not a bad day at the office.
Yeah, a whole lot of days I'll take that. That reminds me, I've been talking about getting Roger on the show and haven't done it yet. Would love to have Roger on. Also want to say hi to a pal of Roger's I met through him, who I know listens to the show, Frank Sorensen. Frank, from what I understand, had an interesting experience out of Treasure Island a couple of weeks ago in their NHC qualifiers. Wouldn't mind talking to Frank at some point, too. So hello, gentlemen, if you're out there listening. I want to mention also our Bad Beat contest is still going on. We have gotten some great responses so far from folks, but you know what? We can't have enough, because I do want to do, if not a whole Bad Beat show, at least a whole Bad Beat half a show. Other than the winner of the contest is going to get $100 in site credit at the new DRF Tournaments platform and going to receive a signed copy of May the Horse Be With You by Harvey Pack. As sort of a, I don't even know if you'd call it a prize, but folks who want, who are submitting their stories, they can get a little bit of a chance to air the psychological demons or whatever you want to say by coming on the show and telling their stories. We'll pick a select group of people to do that. Tell us your bad beat story. You can email us at podcast@drf.com. Keep them coming. Have you had a chance to read through any of these, without giving anything away, Jonathan, chance to read through any of the entries that have been coming in over the transom?
I have been reading through them. And actually, one of them reminded me of what happened yesterday. There's a quick little piece of it. And they're listening. They'll know what I'm talking about. There's a guy that had a story about how a late scratch in a pick six sequence can affect you. You know, you lose the horse that you liked, and then you end up with the favorite. And if you didn't like the favorite, that's not always a good thing. It's kind of a negative and to a certain extent. And it happened to him twice. He lost two horses, so he got tripled up on the horse that he didn't like in the first place. obviously we know where that ended. That horse didn't run well, and he got beat by another horse that they didn't use. So, you know, it reminded me of yesterday at the first leg at Santa Anita. The four horse drove her crazy, was declared a non-starter, which I used. I used that and the favorite. So then I was doubled up on the favorite. And then there's a late scratch, a paddock scratch of the favorite in the second leg. So it's tricky. It's tricky. You know, I'd like for our tote system to somehow get to a place where we can have alternates in case of situations like that.
Does California, if you're on track, allow you to play an alternate? Did I make that up, or is that?
No,
is
I that think that they had like a. I don't know if they still do it right now, but I think they had like a pick six card you would fill out. And there was a place for an alternate. And when you submitted your ticket, you know, if you were to have some kind of scratch situation, there is a place for an alternate. So feels like with our technology, that shouldn't be something that we can't accomplish.
If you would like to think so, but somehow there's technology in the year 2016, right? And then there's tote technology, which like I kind of feel like might as well be 1986 a lot of the time. So you'd be surprised at some of this stuff. But I agree with you. It would be great. It's not a great situation to have to get stuck with horses that you don't want. So whether your bad beat story concerns that type of a thing or something else, send it in to us. I think Mike set the deadline for tomorrow. So if you're listening later in the week, you know what? Go ahead and submit. Even if you're not eligible for the official prize, we can hopefully get you included when we do this Bad Beat show in the next couple of weeks. It's going to be a lot of fun. We didn't really plan an official. Usually I like write a whole rundown for the podcast and have a very strict idea of where we're going with the conversation. I know the topic that we're going to get to in a little bit. I just wanted to talk tournament strategy with Jonathan. A lot of new players coming into the contest universe because of this new DRF tournaments platform, and a lot of folks have been asking questions about strategy, so I wanted to go over some of that stuff, and we'll get to that in a minute. But before we do that, were there any and it's okay if the answer is no, but did you see anything in particular in terms of equine performances over the weekend, Jonathan, that we wanted to talk about a little bit before we dive into the topic of tournament strategy?
Ooh, let's see. I'm trying to remember. when I was watching races at Woodbine and Gulfstream and all kinds of places, getting ready for these tournaments. Nothing that sticks out. It was kind of a slow weekend, it felt like. Obviously, yesterday there was some good racing in New York with the New York Stallion races. The turf race with the cool Lubash and King Creesa was won by that horse that you... that I didn't check my text message early enough.
Oh, no, you didn't see that text? Tapitation?
Yeah, I saw it a little bit late. Too late there. Nothing that stands out. Obviously, you know, it's tricky during Triple Crown season because it feels like a lot of horses, a lot of our stars are pointing towards the big days with Derby Day and Preakness weekend and then Belmont coming up. And so the weekends are a little bit light in terms of our superstars running, but... nonetheless, a 10 claim rule get the job done.
Horses running in circles usually fits the bill for you. That was a cool race, the Mount Vernon. I mean, you got the perfect setup and everything to run at. I was just surprised that Tapitation took as much money as he did. It reminds me how tricky the game can be sometimes in the modern day. People see things. I don't know. I feel like a decade ago that horse is 8 10-12-1, and instead, what did he end up winning at, 7-2? It can be a very difficult thing. The horse that I know you liked in there, King Creesa, ran really well. I thought obviously just got a little bit cooked on the front end, perhaps, or near the front end, attacking that hot pace. But that's a cool group of horses, and hopefully they're going to continue to, even though obviously there's some new players emerging, to go with that group of three who seem to stand out over their competition in the New York male turfbred ranks. But hopefully that's going to be a fun division to follow this year. Did you what did you feel about King Creesa? We're going to be looking for big stuff from him as the year goes on.
Yeah, no, I thought he ran well. I mean, that horse, I can never say his name, whatever. I'll let you do it.
Macagon. People pronounce it differently. That's what I say. I say Macagon. Other people pronounce it differently.
Yeah, you know, chasing that horse, he's a legit speed turf horse, you know, and chasing him around there, and he kind of put him away and then just was too many quality horses running at him late. You know, I think he'll have a good year. Again, you know, what a cool horse he is, you know, I'm a fan of horses that can control their own destiny on the front end in turf races, and so I'll definitely be looking for him this summer to kind of regain his New York crown. Another race I did want to talk about, I forgot all about it, and I didn't, you know, was Lone Star Park yesterday. They had their Lone Star Handicap. It's my home track. I got to go there this weekend and participate in their tournament. It's so nostalgic going there. Like, I actually like went out to the apron and like remembered like all of these like situations in my life where I hit my first try box for like $180 and you know, I just all kinds of cool stuff. And so yesterday, Cyrus Alexander, a half to Super Saver, won their Lone Star Handicap yesterday for Jerry Hollendorfer, and I think Martin Garcia was there. And so they're paying attention. Lone Star is. I talked to one of their marketing guys, and they have been trying to get their Sunday cards as stacked as possible for horse players to pay attention to, right in that little gap between when New York ends and California starts. And so if you're sitting around on a Sunday, pay attention to that. You know, our state could use a little bit of help. We're trying to get things going in order, but we got some political obstacles we have to overcome.
Cyrus Alexander, very familiar to the old school DRF pod listeners. That was one of Matt Bernier's horses who he was thinking about for last year's Triple Crown. We spent a whole lot of time talking about Cyrus Alexander, and I believe Matt even predicted that he's a horse who might go on to do some good things in graded stakes at age 4 and beyond. So definitely a familiar name there. Were you playing in their contest, or was that – I know they had one recently. What's the story with that?
Yeah, no, I was playing in their contest. It's pretty cool. It's they usually do it – they've got four like kind of sessions. They have a round one. They have two round ones that lead to a round two. They're all free. That just concluded. They're going to do another one of those in August. Two round ones that lead to a round two. They give away two seats in each one of those, and then they have kind of like a free for all in like September and October. They're just round twos essentially. They don't have the lead ups to them, but they're free tournaments and. You know, it's a really cool simulcast area they have there, good tables, good food, so it works out pretty good.
Did you happen to notice who did well, or were you gone by that point?
No, it was guys whose names I haven't seen before. You know, that's what's cool about their tournaments is that it's because they're free, because they're in like they're in Texas, so they're like right in the middle, they're kind of away from New York and California, you kind of get to see some new names. One of the guys was telling me that pretty much every guy they usually send out there to Vegas, it's their first time or they're new tour members or whatever, just because they've gotten involved being at the track on a Saturday and they picked up one of the free entries and had a good day.
That's terrific. I'm now tempted to tell you to talk to your friends at Lone Star and get us set up to do a seminar down there or something. It would be fun, a fun place to check out, though. I don't know. You got me real nervous with that comment about the mosquitoes, but if we can find the right time of year, we'll do something. We'll do a podcast live from Lone Star or something. I think it could be pretty cool.
Absolutely. To be honest, we actually had that conversation. I just forgot to tell you about it.
Oh, nice. Well, there you go. I'm really looking for an excuse. You know, I've never been to Austin, despite the fact that I'm a music and food lover.
Yeah, no. Every time you tell me that, I'm shocked. I know you too well to imagine that you haven't been to this place to enjoy those things.
All right. Well, we're going to get that taken care of. Big news in the contest world, which I'm in the process of getting to the bottom of. Not the first time this has happened. I know of at least one other instance, but yesterday, Brett Wiener, former NHC Tour second place finisher 2 years ago when Eric Moomy won, and generally speaking, a force in contests. He won the Saratoga tournament last year, and you see his name on a whole lot of leaderboards. He qualified for the NHC twice yesterday. Once was in the DRF Bets contest, and then there was another online contest that he punched his ticket in there. Very similar to your approach to multi-tickets from what I could see, Jonathan, where he was playing the same horses across entries, and he had a day and got it done. I'm very curious to try to track Brett down and talk to him. Always an entertaining interview, and get a little bit of the skinny. There was also an online cash game yesterday on yet another site where he won a whole bunch of money. He's heating up, and I'm curious to see if he's interested in making another tour run. A lot of these folks who've gone deep on the tour a couple of years in a row, or even 1 year, there's sort of a bounce period where you try to get back to some semblance of a normal life in subsequent years. And then other folks like you, Jonathan, you get the taste of it, and you just want to keep pushing and going for it. Not sure which side of that spectrum Brett Wiener's on, but we're going to take a look and see if we can find out. We also had a BC qualify action. We sent six players to win their full $10,000 BC berths. That was in a contest on Saturday. I'm not going to list them here. I'm going to do a full write-up of that contest, and we're going to have that information up on the site later today. Some familiar names, some new names. It should be good reading to check that out. So now, let's talk to the people out there who are thinking of getting involved in contests. They are maybe excited by the prospect that on the new DRF tournament site, you can play during the week, and you can play for as little. I didn't actually check what the lowest buy-in this week is. Last week, the cheapest contest buy-in was $18. You don't even already need your NHC Tour membership. You can just deposit $18 on the DRF tournament site and get yourself started on a contest career. So let's ask Jonathan. Your advice to an absolute newbie, somebody who's playing in their first contest, maybe we'll say they're a novice-type handicapper. They know how to read the racing form. We're not going with a complete newbie here, but somebody who knows how to read the form, but they haven't really dipped their toe in the contest water. Give me your advice for this person.
Yeah, so I think the best thing is that, which you've already kind of talked about, is that it's an opportunity to get involved for big money for little. You know, it's like on Derby Day, spending $24 on a trifecta that could turn into $100,000. You never know. It's the same idea. You don't have to spend $300 to get involved. And I think the feeders is the best way. I think it gives you practice, it gives you experience, it gives you action during the week, controlled action with a controlled price. You know that you can get a full day action for $18, which I love. The idea that on a day where you might not have got to attack the card preparation-wise like you'd like, you're diving in for $18, not a $150 investment into the pick four that you barely handicap. So that's one of my favorite parts about it. One of the things that I do is I prepare myself, for instance, coming up this weekend, there's the Belmont Stakes feeder. For the Belmont Stakes Challenge on Belmont Day, the $10,000 live money tournament. What I'm going to do is I'm going to mentally set aside $325 this week to play at least one entry on Saturday or Sunday. Let me just tell you real quick on Saturday. What I'll do on Thursday and Friday is I'll play the $25 or $36 rather, the $36 feeder on Thursday and Friday, and if I happen to do well in there, then I'll have two entries on Saturday. If I don't, then I'll only have one. So I kind of split up my accounting there, where I can try to, I'll try to get two entries, but I'm not going to buy two entries just because I play every weekend, and so that can add up pretty quickly. So I'll try to qualify some in, and I'll do the same with the NHC deals. Every day I'll play an $18 feeder to see if I can qualify in, especially now that I'm double qualified. I'm not really trying to spend, $300 and $70 every weekend trying to qualify for something that I've already qualified for just for tour points. So I use the feeders as a way to try to save a little bit of money, get some action during the week, work on my game. It's something that I think is underrated. The more you play, the better you are. The more you play, the more you're able to kind of see the angles in which we find long shots. You know, you learn. And yesterday I learned a lesson, with that horse that won at Santa Anita, the one that we talked about, Rogers Singling. You know, that horse ran well as a two-year-old, had a long time off, and came back as a three-year-old with positive works, and he's going to be a horse that's 15-1. That's the kind of horse you want to use. You want to expect that there's going to be some type of an improve, and that's from playing every day. And so these feeders kind of allow you to do that.
You've described it as muscle memory. You develop sort of a muscle memory of what these horses at prices look like. And I think tournaments, for whatever reason, it seems to me people develop that better in tournaments than they do in cash games. What reason do you suppose there is for that?
Well, like I talked about, actually, I just got a note from Elliot Honecker, which is funny you mentioned this, that he just said that he read the interview in the Davidowitz book, and I actually talked about it in there, is that tournaments gave me the confidence to play 10, 15-1 shots that, as a young player, I didn't have the confidence to play with cash in my pocket. For instance, like that horse that I described yesterday, the horse that had the big race of the two-year-old, the one that ran at Santa Anita. That's the kind of horse that I would use in a tournament, but the old me would not really include that horse or key that horse and exact the bets or trifecta bets because I didn't have the confidence that I was good enough to select a horse that was 15-1 that could win. And I think that playing in tournaments in a controlled environment where I knew that my only risk was $18, and tournaments also teach you that favorites aren't necessarily the types of horses you want to play. It gives you the experience selecting other horses that are better value and then seeing them be successful. It gives you the confidence to do that with real cash in your pocket when you start playing at the windows.
You mentioned the Bell contest a minute ago, the Belmont Stakes Day contest. I just wanted to underline a couple of points about the Belmont Stakes contest. For one, I believe their entries are closing this Saturday. So if you're planning on playing in that and you want to reserve your spot, make sure to do that in the next couple days. Get in touch with Donnie Nelson. And you might want to consider doing that. Now, I don't have any inside info on this, but just doing some basic math about what they're guaranteeing. I'm sure it's going to be a successful contest. I do think there's an opportunity that, because of how high their guarantee is, that there's going to be an overlay in that prize pool. It's not unlike the situation we were talking about before, where more money is going to get paid out than goes in. You're already dealing with no takeout. Well, you're dealing with takeout in terms of the takeout on the cash bets you make within that contest environment. But the money that goes in the prize pool for that contest, nothing gets taken out of it. That's a New York state law thing. So you can count on that already. And you have a chance of maybe some added money in that prize pool. I'm going to do some reporting on this week and see if I can find out what the actual numbers are. But just as a heads up to folks listening on the podcast, I'm pretty sure that's going to be a really good situation in terms of how much prize money is getting paid out versus how much prize money is going in. So you might want to reserve your spot for that contest anyway. And then throw in the fact, as Jonathan was mentioning, you can qualify for small money potentially through our feeders on DRF tournaments. Let me tell you this. If I were eligible, I'd be playing max entries in every single Belmont feeder this week. Do you have the schedule in front of you, Jonathan? Do you know what we have announced specifically for the Belmont contest?
I do. It's on Thursday for $36, there's a feeder. Friday for $36, there's a feeder. And then on Saturday, the tournament itself is $325, and that's, like I said, that's on Saturday.
Yeah, I would load up for that, folks. I think it's going to be a really good opportunity. I'm it would have been awesome to see Nyquist win and have a third attempt at a Triple Crown in a row for Belmont Day. But in another sense, I'm loving the idea that we keep the Faro special, and also that maybe we won't have 70,000 out there for Belmont Day. I mean, maybe we will, and for my friends at Naira, I want it to be as big a day as possible, but just sort of selfishly in terms of entering and exiting the plant there, maybe just like 10% more mellow wouldn't be such a bad thing. Does that make me a lousy person that I'm okay with that, Jonathan?
No. You're just, you know that you'll be there supporting it, so you don't feel guilty about hoping that they don't have very many people there.
And it's looking like it's going to be a super fun week out there. More and more over the last few years, I feel like the Thursday and the Friday have become these really fun industry days where people are coming in from all over the country. We're going to get a chance to see a lot of folks who've been guests on the show, folks who listen to the show. So if you're around, keep an eye out. Are you going to be there Thursday and Friday?
Probably not Thursday, because I'm gonna go out to New York this weekend for the Monmouth tournament, and so then I'm gonna come back to Austin, then go back to New York. I'm gonna go back. You know, I feel like I should stay here as long as I can. No, not staying.
That's your mistake. I know a lot of tournament players are planning on coming from Monmouth this weekend and then just staying through the whole thing. But if you're around on Thursday, you know, for the races that make sense to go look in the paddock, and I would define those as anytime we're looking at young and improving type horses, and especially maidens, I project to be down on the clubhouse side of the paddock. Please say hello. That will be a hoot. And I think our friend Nick Tamaro has a table upstairs on Wednesday or on Thursday where I'll be hanging with him. It should be a fun few days. I'm really looking forward to next week. Let's talk for a second about the Monmouth tournament. I know they have exceeded their expectations in terms of how many players are participating. They are closed, I believe, in terms of just buying in. But looking at that DRF tournament schedule, Jonathan, are we doing anything for Monmouth, or is it kind of just all set at this point?
It's all set, all said and done at this point.
So you're out of luck there if you're not in already. If you're going to be out there, it should be a great day. It'll be fun to follow. And just keep it on your radar for the next one. Monmouth have really sort of been the East Coast version of Santa Anita in the way that they've taken up residence at the top of the food chain in terms of running these live bankroll qualifiers, and thrilled to be able to partner with them, and thrilled that they've gotten the numbers that they were looking for and then some for this Pick Your Prize Challenge next weekend. It should be a lot of fun. When are you getting in for that one? Are you staying in the city? Are we taking the boat down? How are we doing this weekend?
I'm going to be there Friday. I think I'm actually this week I'm going to stay close to the trike. And then next week for the Belmont, I'm going to stay in the city. So.
Gotcha.
We'll probably have to.
So I'm taking the boat down by myself. I'm having my Bloody Mary on the boat ride down by myself, is what you're telling me.
Essentially, yeah, pretty much.
We'll get that all sorted out. You also mentioned, Jonathan, and if I were you, I would mention this in every conversation I had with anybody too, that you were one of the players selected to be in, sort of give expert testimony in the new Steve Davidowitz racing book about handicapping on racing's biggest days. What is the official title of the book? Do you know that off the top of your head? I didn't give it last week, and I had about 15 people tell me. Why didn't you give the official title?
Cashing Big on Racing's Biggest Days.
It's a really cool book. We are going to have a very special event for listeners and for us too. On Thursday, Mike's still in the process of moving. The show will be me and Jonathan and special guest Steve Davidowitz. And we are going to be asking him, he's going to be exhausted by the end for all the questions we're going to be peppering him with. And I want to put the opportunity out there to listeners. If you have questions for Steve, you can mention them to me on Twitter, @loomsboldly. If you want to send Davidowitz questions to podcast@drf.com, we can accommodate you that way. This guy, I mean, he's one of the best-selling handicapping authors of all time. He looks at the world a slightly different way. No less of a giant in our subsection of this industry of handicapping than Andy Beyer considers him a mentor. This guy, you're going to want to pick his brain. So if you have any questions for Steve Davidowitz, please reach out to us. We're going to have him on the show on Thursday. All right, Jonathan, before you gave a pretty good outline of the why of playing in these low bankroll feeders, let's spend a minute talking about the how. Now, that question is colored by the fact that for now, all the feeders that we're running are of the all-in format, where all the picks must be in before the first race. We've talked about this a little bit before, so I'm going to ask a more specific question, and that is, if you're a newer player playing in these feeders, obviously, you're going to want to stay very close to the idea, though the old Paul Sherman thing, play who you like. But beyond that, let's say you have a range of horses that you like, maybe two or three in a given race. What price horse are you ideally looking to play in the all-in format?
In all-in formats, especially during the weekend feeders when there's not, you know, the fields are typically a little bit smaller. The quality of the racing is a little bit different, I would say, than it is on the weekends when you're playing in the larger ones. In the all-ins, you're usually playing 8 to 10 races. In the Saturday live or all-in, you're playing in, you know, 12 to 15 races. So I don't look at – that's my long way of saying I don't look at the odds so much. I just try to pick winners, and I just try to pick horses that I think make sense. Now, I think the biggest thing when it comes to all-ins, the biggest thing that you have to get good at and will make the difference on whether or not you do well or not – is your ability to differentiate between a favorite that is worth playing and a favorite that's not worth playing. And I think that that's the sneakiest part about it, because if you can get that $4 horse to win and you use them, that is an unbelievable advantage when you're playing in the smaller field. You know, there's 20, 30 people in them, 15, 20, 30, 40 people in them, rather than 180 that you play like on a Saturday. It's a huge advantage to grab that $6. You never know when that $6 is going to be needed. That can be the $6 difference between you and someone else both having a 10-to-1 shot. You know, if you have a 10-to-1 shot, another guy has a 10-to-1 shot, but he's bombing away on his entire ticket, and you go ahead and take the obvious $4 horse, now you're ahead of him. And so I think that that's you know, during the week, that's usually the difference. It's usually a $4 horse that makes the difference during the week when I actually advance – advance a feeder spot to a qualifier. The other thing is, you know, that's the first way to look at it. Now, if you play two entries, which sometimes I'll do during the week, usually I'll start off playing one, but if I like the sequence of races, I'll go ahead and grab another entry. And then it becomes very important, like it always does, is whether or not you're going to play the same horse on two entries or not. Because if you do, like I said, you can get to position. So often I feel like I'm in third and fifth or fourth and fifth or first and seventh or first and fifth, where I have two horses essentially in the last leg that can get me advanced. So I would definitely look at both options, especially in the lower denomination. I mean, if you look at it in the NHC, you can play two entries on Thursday, two entries on Friday for $72. And that's still less than 50% of how much it would cost if you were to buy a full entry on Saturday. And so you can really get some pretty good coverage there, get in for half the price if you can get lucky enough to get one of those entries home.
So are you saying, Jonathan, that what your preferred strategy, playing two tickets in the all-in format, keep your tickets kind of the same and then spread out late? Or does it all depend on, because there's a logic to that to me. I never really thought about it like that, but thinking about it for a second right now, that seems kind of smart, but I didn't think that's how you did it. I thought you were more about keeping them together where your opinions were strongest and dividing them up where your opinions diverged. But
no, absolutely. No, you're right. My example of the story was probably misleading. You're right. I try to stay the same where I can stay the same, and then I differentiate wherever it is, whether it's early in the sequence or late in the sequence. I don't really care where it is. I just want to, you know, I want to take the 5-to-2 shot, and I want to have them on both tickets. And then in the 10-horse turf race where I'm not really sure, I want to use the 7-to-1 and the 12-to-1. You know what I mean? That's the kind of that's my logic when I'm approaching it with two tickets, is I try to pick the same as many places I can. In fact, yesterday I played two entries in a feeder, and I picked all the same horses except for one spot.
Now you did have a split ticket issue over the weekend, didn't you? Was that in an all-in contest? What happened to you there?
I didn't. In that one, it was just the sequences on Saturday were kind of crazy, and I couldn't narrow to one horse, and so I played two entries, and I picked a different. It was all-in format, and I picked a different horse on every and on both entries, and which is something that people
we
got to
talk about
me
that
play,
for a second.
Yeah, I don't ever do that. I just,
yeah.
That's just where I ended up, and I scored like 50 or 60 on both ones, on both of them. It was one of those deals where if it was live, I would have zigged and zagged and changed it around a little bit, and I probably would have done a little bit better, but it's typically not something that I do, and it happened.
How did you – now, okay, let's call your top opinion in a race A and your second opinion B. When you're doing those two tickets in the all-in format, are you doing all A's on one, all B's on the other, or are you going A, B, A, B, A, B? Because obviously the whole deal of multi-ticket strategy changes so much when you can't change those picks. How did you decide which horse to put where?
Well, here's the thing, is I did all A, right? So I did all A on one entry. So when I say all A, I mean that's my top choice. If I was playing one ticket by itself, those are the 12 horses that I would have used. And then on my second entry, it's technically my B, where if I wasn't playing the horse I was playing on my A, this is the horse I would play. Now, the crazy thing about it is I can tell you at least 10 times last year where my B ticket did better than my A ticket. I mean, it happens. It happens a lot. Because you got to think, and you still like the horse, and not always, but a lot of times your B horse typically will be a larger price, typically.
Because if you're Jonathan Kinchin, yes, typically.
Yes. Now,
if you like chalk the way that you do, yes.
Yeah, like our friend, the man who remains unnamed that dresses in all black, he tells me that he picks, if he likes two horses, he picks the longest price one. And so maybe it's opposite for some people, but you got to
think.
Yeah,
that's sort of the old school tournament player mentality is, right? Torn between two, even if it's close, always go with the longer shot. But I think especially for an all-in feeder, that dynamic gets flipped on its head. And I just think in general, some of the older school tournament guys, I mean, gosh, some of them, they do incredibly well, and I'm certainly not criticizing, but I do think sometimes they lean maybe a little too much towards the longer price or bust, which in certain tournament formats I still think is correct. Something like a tournament like the Horse Player World Series, for example. The field is so big. There's so many races. I kind of think for success, that's what you need to do. But in any time you're dealing with mandatory races, I think the way, Jonathan, you approach it of being happier to put the points up on the board, even if it's a 5-2 instead of a 4-1, I definitely see that logic.
They're the points that you need. I can't tell you how many times I've been even in a live and a pick and pray, I've been in the last race, and I'm just like, I just need 45 cents. I need 40 cents. That's all I need is 40 cents. And you look back at all these opportunities where you could have got 40 cents, but you tried to get too cute. And so, you know, I just take it when I need it, and sometimes I get beat and sometimes I don't. But, you know, for me, I approach it with who is the most likely winner of this race. And then I look at that horse's price, and then I say who is the next most likely winner. And then I look at that horse's price, and then I decide, do the odds suggest that this is a smart play for me to take this, you know, 6-5 shot, or should I take this 5-1 shot? And that's where the theory of letting the favorite protect you comes in, where you have to make that decision. And a lot of times I do that. There's a lot of spots where I feel like there's a horse that presents a lot of value, and I don't think he's the most likely winner, but I'll let the favorite protect me. It happened yesterday, as a matter of fact, at Churchill. There was a race with a Baffert horse, Jazzy Times, that was going to be really short. I thought he was the most likely winner. He was the horse that I would have singled in a pick five, but I figured I'm going to let him protect me, and I'm going to take a shot with this horse, Gray Sky, who was 5-1. Gray Sky got a ridiculous ride and didn't run well, and Jazzy Times got beat. Those situations, when that happens, I'm not going to win that day. When I try to let the favorite protect me and I go in a different direction, and the favorite doesn't protect me, it's usually not a good sign moving forward.
Define a little bit more what you mean by let the favorite protect you there, because I'm following you, but I'm not sure that everybody is.
Right. So in a situation where you know, there's a favorite in a race that is 6-5, right? And you think that the horse is likely, but it's not American Pharoah, right? It's not like the horse can't lose. If there's a situation where there's a favorite who's 6-5, who has a pace advantage, a class advantage, a figure advantage, like I'm playing the horse. But if there's a horse that's 6-5 that's coming off of a layoff, or that's 6-5 that had a bad race last time, or 6-5 for, you know, whatever reason, it just doesn't all...
One of four contenders in the race, you know, doesn't right. really separate themselves from the rest of the field.
Right. I'll let, then, you know what, let, this is a time where I'm cool with giving up the $6. I'll let, if that horse wins, no one's going to catastrophically ruin my chances for the day, and I'm going to play a price horse and hope that the price horse wins or the favorite wins. And I essentially have two horses that I've used in that spot because the favorite's not going to hurt me. So, you know, that's what I mean by let the favorite protect you. Now, in those situations, when you let the favorite protect you and you're wrong and another price hits, it's usually not going to be a great day. And so those are the type of situations where if you get into a situation where you want to let the favorite protect you, that's the type of a situation where I'd love to have two entries so that I can have two opportunities to catch that price horse. And if it doesn't work out, the favorite wins, pay $6. No one's pulled away from you. In a lot of these tournaments, people won't play that horse anyways. So it's there's really a lot less for you to be concerned about. But those are the situations between letting the favorite protect you. I think the biggest decisions that need to be made in tournaments is, are you going to let the favorite protect you, or are you going to take what the race gives you? And I think, you know, they're won or lost on those decisions.
That logic, I'm sure, serves you very well as a multi-race player as well. Do you see a connection between those two ideas?
Yeah, I do, and I've tried to get better at that. I'm trying to get better. One of the things that I've tried to stop doing is, you know, I try not to use odds on horses. I try not to use multiple horses in legs if one of them is odds on. I either single that horse or I toss the horse. I don't want to use three horses and one of them's odds on in a leg. I feel like that's a really bad value situation where you're never going to end up on top in that spot. I'd rather just toss the horse or single the horse if you're going to use a horse that's odds on. And so that, you know, that's something that I've developed over time by playing in so many tournaments where you realize that 4-5 shots lose all the time, and you just got to be there at the right time to catch them.
Let's talk a little bit about tournament math. A lot of players, very mathematically oriented, will come up with like specific score targets and try to play tickets to get to it to a certain total. And I'll go over some of the benchmarks in a minute that I would use if I were somebody playing in these feeders. But first, let me ask you, Jonathan, how important is math in your conscious mind when you're putting together your tournament entries?
Well, I don't ever do that. I don't ever, and I understand why people do it, and I understand the math behind it, but I've played in way too many tournaments that, you know, the winning score is $75, the winning score is $180, the winning score is, you know, I've won head-to-heads that are, I've had $14, I've won head-to-heads where I've had $120. Your math does not matter. It's what horses run and how it all unfolds. I mean, I'm not that mathematical, so there's no way for me to do it. Any math question I have, I defer it to my buddy Eric Bilek, who's an engineer.
Eric's good with the tournament math, very much.
Yeah, I blow him up. Eric, I need this. Who can I play? Who can I not play? I'll worry about the handicapping. You just tell me the math part. So I understand it. I understand having a target. But I feel more comfortable addressing the horses that are running and addressing the likelihood of those horses winning in those races rather than guessing what prices I need and then making that influence my decision. It's like in baseball saying like, oh, we're going to need 8 runs to win. So we're going to decide that in the first inning. So we're going to just swing for home runs the entire time. And the next thing you know, you could have won 1-0 if you played small ball, but you missed that opportunity because you thought you needed 8 runs. And that was a pretty good analogy for a non-baseball guy, huh?
Yeah, I was going to say, I didn't even know you knew the rules of baseball. So it's impressive that you pulled that one out. And I do think there's something to be said. For me, it comes down to just sort of how your brain works and just your own individual aspects as a player. For me, like when I'm handicapping a race, for example, I know that the winning speed figure of the race is not going to be generated by some outside force like a par. It's going to be generated by what those horses in that race are going to run that day. However, it just helps my brain understand the problem it's trying to solve by knowing that the par is 83. It just gives me a lens and a way of looking at the world. Now, with tournaments, I'm less beholden to what the answer is, but I still want to know. And generally speaking, the long-established threshold in the common online formats is that 2.5 times your initial bankroll, that is going to give you the median of the winning score, the average and the median of the winning score. So let's say it's an 8-race contest and you're betting $2 win place. You're looking at your average score is going to be, let's see, 2 in place, so 4 per race times 8 races is 32. Your average score is going to be 2.5 times 32. So, putting myself on the spot here to actually do some math, which was a mistake because I didn't have that extra cup of coffee, but that's a pretty simple equation. I'll let you figure it out for yourself. And that's what, on average, those tournaments are going to yield as a winning score. Another way to look at it in that same instance, I was talking to Josh Camus, another guy who listens to the show from time to time, and we know from Twitter, Jersey Josh, he uses that threshold. He looks at it another way and says, if it's a $2 win place contest, $10 per race. And he went with that and got himself qualified into NHCQ on Sunday. He didn't do very well on NHCQ, but got himself qualified thinking about it in terms of, okay, I need $10 a race. Now, I think Jonathan's answer makes a lot of sense, and I think a lot of people are going to feel the same way and do it that way. But if you're curious to know what the math is, that's basically how it breaks down. 2.5 times your initial bankroll, specifically in a typical online event. Now, when you're changing it from a live contest to an all-in contest, there's actually some disagreement about what happens to the scores. I've heard, to me, logically, and my assumption is that in the all-in format, the scores are going to be lower because people can't chase you. People can't just play long shots late in the contest to catch whatever the leader has. Jonathan, is that your understanding when you're looking at an all-in contest versus a live contest? Which score is typically higher?
Oh, I would think that the all-ins are definitely going to be lower, but I would think the median is probably the same. I just think that the top is probably higher, but the median is probably the same for those two contests, or pretty close.
That's a good point. That's a good point, because it's those instances where it's all bombs coming in and people can change their picks that are going to influence those scores. So there's a lot of stuff on tournament math in the Winning Contest Player. If you're curious, definitely check it out. You can pick up a copy of that at the DRF store. If you're looking for a signed copy, feel free to reach out on Twitter. We'll figure out a way to get you sorted out. But Jonathan, not interviewed in the Winning Contest Player because I didn't know him at the time. Perhaps if we ever do a revise, though, you can share some of these thoughts. I love some of the ideas that you bring to this stuff, Jonathan, in some ways more complex, in some ways more simple than a lot of the established contest wisdom. Any other thoughts you want to share for newer contest players when they're tackling either the all-in format or when they graduate, they do well, they finish in the top 10% of the feeder and move on to a qualifier on a Saturday or Sunday?
Yeah, you know, another thing that I would do is if you have a racing buddy, partner up early in the week, right? You know, say, look, let's try to get qualified for this Belmont thing. You know, it's $325. We have we can play two entries for $36, or for $72. We can play $72 a day. We can play two entries. I mean, you could even play $144 worth of entries. You play two, they play two, and then you just see how many seats you can get into the Belmont tournament on Saturday, and then you guys are partners, and you've got really good coverage. You've got a ton of coverage to try to get your seats in there. And that's another way to try to get involved. The NHC as well. It's a little bit harder to be partners in the NHC. I mean, it's
people do it.
It's yeah, but it's tougher. It's a little bit easier, I think, in like a live money setting. But either way, if you haven't played, get involved. It's just fun on a Thursday. There's nothing better than than sitting around in your office, if you can, with a little window up at Belmont in the sixth, which you normally wouldn't be paying too much attention to, and it could be a big opportunity for you to get involved in the NHC or the Breeders' Cup Betting Challenge or whatever it might be. So it's a lot of fun. I tell you what, tournaments have changed my horse racing life significantly. But it's just a fun way to get involved, to compete, to see your name on the leaderboard, to add a little bit of strategy and gamesmanship to what it is that, you know, we all love to do, which is to figure out the puzzle of a 10 claimer on a Wednesday at Belmont or Gulfstream or whatever it might be. So if you haven't tried it, you know, give it a swing. I'm sure most people listening have.
I love that partners idea, and we have another minute or two. I want to talk about that for a minute. Again, I think that's the kind of thing that really depends on your personality and the personality of your friends, because there's a lot of horror stories about partnerships gone wrong. Oh, I told them to play that horse. If only I'd done XYZ. Ron Myers, who won the Kentucky Derby contest, frequently in the past had played with partners who he just sort of broke out from, and he said, gosh, had I had my partners in this contest, there's no way I would have won. They never would have let me bet whatever it was, 4,000 to place on Nyquist in the Derby. So there's definitely some instances where you're better off going on your own. But what are the benefits, Jonathan, of playing with partners as you see them?
Well, one of the things that I've done in the past, and I haven't done it a lot, just a few times where, you know, these things get expensive. You're playing a lot of tournaments, and what, you know, if we're both going to be going to a situation, we'll keep our anonymity, right? So I do what I want to do, and you do what you want to do. We're just at the end of the day partners. So if I win 10 grand, then you win 5 grand. But you're not involved in what it is that I'm doing. We're just, you know, we're economic partners. We're equity partners, not decision-making partners. So that's one way that you can do it.
Yeah. Are you talking like 50-50 in that situation?
Yeah,
you might take 20%.
Right. Yeah, no, I mean, 50. It's usually a 50-50 thing. I mean, it's typically the times that I've, you know, for instance, Nick Tamaro and I, we went partners at Del Mar because I'd qualified an entry in for their live money tournament. I think he might have bought in, and we just made a decision that we didn't even talk about decision making. I mean, outside of our normal decision making process. At the end of the day, whatever money he had or I had, we were splitting it. So he was a little bit mad at me when I went all in on a 5-2 shot that ran second. But he got over it. He got over it. So anyways, you know, he busted out too, but it took him a lot longer. So you could do the same thing with these feeders, you know. If person A gets two entries on Thursday, person B gets two entries on Thursday, you guys, he plays his, you play yours, or she plays hers and you play yours. And then if you get an entry into Saturday, whoever got the entry into Saturday, they get to make the decisions. They just make the decisions. You know, they can talk to you if they want your opinion or whatever. And then if you happen to qualify for Belmont, then you guys can work it out if you want to do 50-50 or you can just make all the decisions. And then if you win, then you split the money with them. There's a lot of ways to do it with silent partners, and there's a lot of ways to do it with partners that are involved.
Yeah, and that's what the other point I wanted to make. I mean, I think the most famous set of playing partners are Don Beardsworth and Dennis DeCower. They're so good. You know what they did is they ran second in the NHC 2 years in a row, once on a DeCower ticket and once on a Beardsworth ticket. And they really talk about the races, and they sort of have a sense of years of playing together whose opinion is the stronger one when they have different opinions in a race. And they've sort of – as their friendship has evolved, they sort of intuitively know which horse to play, and they both have the kind of personalities where the person, if it goes wrong and the player whose pick didn't get used, if that horse wins, like, there's no hard feelings. They just this water off a duck's back, and they keep going forward. And so if you have a friend in racing who you – and it's a rare thing, but if you have a friend in racing who you can develop that kind of relationship with, it's not a bad idea in sort of a – two heads are better than one way, or another way to do it would be to divide it up. It's an 8-race tournament, 4 races at Santa Anita, 4 races at the Will Rogers Downs. One partner does Will Rogers Downs, one partner does Santa Anita. It's another way to get a little bit of extra mental energy on the races at hand, if that's appealing to you and if you have the right kind of relationship. And I'm I'm a huge believer that the people who you hang out with at the track are important. You know, we've all seen some negative energy at the track. And for me, like, that's really hard to be around. And I try to avoid it. On the other hand, when you hang out with players who win or players who have a winning attitude, that can really turn things around. And you can't help but learn something just by osmosis hanging around with people like that. And I'm talking about, not just talking about winning, I'm also just talking about having a good time and putting some energy out in the world there. Are you in agreement? Am I being flaky here, Jonathan, or do you agree with the importance of your company as far as turning yourself into a winning player?
Oh, absolutely. I've had to make some conscious decisions to distance myself from negative people. It just brings down your overall vibe. You know, the guy in your office who's just running around complaining about the boss all day, and the next thing you know, like, you're starting to complain about the boss, and then, like, you know, it's just not good. I'd rather focus on the positive things. The racetrack's supposed to be fun. It's not supposed to be doom and gloom. And so, you know, I'm one of the things I'm most proud of in life are and that I mean this from the bottom of my heart, are my racetrack friends. I think that I hang out with a really great group of accomplished guys that are fun to be around, that are positive, that love the sport, who will complain from time to time. You know, I mean, we all do. We get beat. It's a tough sport, but you know, I think you should surround yourself by people that are going to make you feel good about what you're doing and make it fun to do it, you know. So 100% agree.
Maybe we'll have to do a column on that in future. I loved your answer there. Yeah, I'm not saying there's no complaining allowed. I'm just saying some people take it a little too far. Everybody needs a good whine every now and again, and that's why the Bad Beat Contest, I think, is connected with our audience so much. It's nice to give people a forum to complain about the stories that deserve to be aired, as opposed to just any time you lose, oh, so-and-so's cheating. You know, it's just, I don't need to hear that. It's tedious and it's distracting, I think, from the bigger goals that we have. All right, I think we've gone our allotted time today, Jonathan. Thank you so much for sharing your insights into the tournament world for our audience. A special thanks to Charlie Zegers, who I don't thank enough. He's our producer for a lot of these podcasts, and he's done a great job since we sort of slid back into the audio-only pods, working with Mike Hogan to make sure these shows get up in a timely manner and that everything sounds as good as it can. So thank you to Charlie. Thanks to Mike Hogan, a rare show that he misses. He's been the stalwart of the pod from the beginning. Not bad for a guy who was initially not even in an on-air role, huh? And thanks the most to all of you for listening. Really enjoy doing these podcasts a couple times a week. We are going to be back on Thursday with Steve Davidowitz. Get those Bad Beat stories in, podcast@drf.com, and may you win all your photos.